find 1 Samuel chapter 2. 1 Samuel chapter 2. We'll be starting in verse number 12 this morning, and we'll be looking at the entire rest of the chapter, which ends in verse 36. We won't necessarily read all of these verses, but we will be talking about them this morning. So let me encourage you to go back, and if you want to read them this afternoon after you get home, get you some lunch in you. So, all right, so we left off last week with the first half of chapter 2, which is where the story where Samuel's mother and family, Hannah and Elkanah, they're going to come up again today, where they bring Samuel to the Lord, to the house at Shiloh, to the tabernacle at Shiloh, to the house of the Lord, and they present Samuel there, and he's going to stay there and be a servant of the Lord forever. And then Hannah writes this wonderful song that outlines kind of the rest of the book, really, and we'll kind of see some of that even today. And so today we pick up Samuel and his family will play a part in the story, but they are not the main characters of the story. Some other people that we've met are the main characters, namely Eli and his two sons, Hophni and Phinehas. And so I may refer to them each by their name or as the House of Eli, which is all three of them together, okay? And so they're going to serve as the main characters for our story today. And so we're going to kind of walk through it. Now, I'm going to be honest with you. I'm going to give you this up front. We're not going to go straight from verse 12 all the way through 36. We're going to kind of talk about this, and then we'll jump down and pick up a point here, and then kind of come back, and then we'll finish up, okay? I've got it outlined in the, hopefully, hopefully I've got it on the screen for you in the correct order. All right, so let's read. We're going to read verse 12, and then we've got to talk about it, okay? And then we'll kind of answer a question that this verse brings up. All right, now, verse 12. Now the sons of Eli, that's Hophni and Phinehas, were worthless men. They did not know the Lord. Now you might remember, if you've been with us for a couple weeks, if you haven't, you can go back and read it. In the first sermon in, not the introduction, but the first sermon in Samuel's actual text, we read this same word, worthless. You remember? It's when Hannah is praying at the temple or at the tabernacle. She's at the door, and Eli is sitting there beside the door, and she's praying in such a way that makes Eli think she's a drunkard. And what does she tell Eli? Don't treat me as a worthless woman, right? And we see that is absolutely the case. That word worthless there means of no worth, specifically in relation to righteous behavior. In other words, she's saying, please don't treat me like an unrighteous drunkard woman. That's not who I am. And we see that is not who she is. Well, today we are going to see the opposite is true. Eli's two sons are, I went back and looked over my notes this morning, and I tried to use every thesaurus word for wanton, reckless, evil that I could. And I got tired of writing the same word over and over because they are so bad. So hopefully we'll use a plethora of descriptive words, adjectives, to describe how bad they are this morning. They are wantonly evil in every way and are truly worthless in regard to righteous behavior. Now, this text also says, and this is an interesting point, the second sentence in here says what? They did not know the Lord. Now, that causes us to ask a question. How did they not know the Lord? All right, let me ask you a question. Feel free to answer. What was Eli's role? He was a priest, which means his sons were priests, which is so we're all on the same page. Priests were there to help you worship the Lord. You with me so far? So how do they not know the Lord? Know there means not intellectual. It means how do they not have a relationship with the Lord? Well, we're about to answer that question because the text gives us two very good reasons to reveal that they don't know the Lord. Like, here's how we can say that. But in old preacher language, we could equate it this way. You may have heard this before. They might have known God in their head, but they didn't know God in their heart. Right? They should have known the law. We'll see, they really don't. Or at least they do. They don't care about it. But they would have been taught all the ins and outs of how to of the law, of what to do, of what sacrifices should be offered, and how they should be offered. They knew all the intellectual stuff about the Lord, but they did not give two hoots and a holler about serving the Lord. And therefore, the author tells us they do not know the Lord. Now, again, that major question is, how can the author say that? Like, how can he just make, like, he's making a very declarative statement. They're worthless, they're not righteous, and they don't know the Lord. That's a declarative statement. How can he make that? Well, that's a good question. He's about to answer that in two ways. And the first one comes in verses 13 through 17. Now, before we read those verses, here's what you have to know. Leviticus chapter 7. Ugh. Anybody read that this morning? Leviticus chapter 7? Probably not, okay? Probably not. So, we've got to talk for just a minute. We got to get in the weeds. Come with me. We got to get in the weeds of the sacrificial system of Israel. Because if you don't, these next few verses are going to be like, huh? Okay? So, I'm not going to read all of Leviticus 7 this morning. But I'm going to give you three bullet points that come out of Leviticus 7. Leviticus chapter 7 is all about two things. Sacrifices and the priest's portion of the sacrifices. So here's what that means. Whenever you in ancient Israel brought a sacrifice to the tabernacle or to the temple, a part of that animal, now you could bring bread or grain or flour or wine and oil, that was all part of it, but let's just assume it's an animal because that's what the text is going to talk about in 1 Samuel. When you bring an animal, a portion of that animal is offered on the altar, burn up on the fire, and then you get some of the meat and the priests get some of the meat. Okay, you with me so far? So if we're to sum up all of Leviticus 7, you need to know three things. Number one, God gives very specific detail about how sacrifices should be offered. Very specific detail. I mean, way more detail than you can imagine. Like, he gives very specific detail. All right? The second thing we see out of Leviticus 7 is not all the time, is all of the animal put on the fire as a sacrifice to the Lord. Most of the time, they only put on the fire blood, fat, and some of the organs. Okay? Now, I say some, there are one exception, but the majority of the time, that is what is burned as the sacrificial offering to the Lord. Okay? Now, again, God's very specific, so it may be a little bit different for each sacrifice, which Hophni and Phinehas would have been required to know. Got it? All right. Here's the third thing. For all of these sacrifices, the priests were allowed to take part of the sacrifice for themselves. In one case, they get a portion of the meat. In one case, they get the skin of the animal. In another case, they might get some of the bread and wine. And you say, well, why would they need that? Like, why would they do that? Here's why. Because they served at the temple. They did not go out and grow a garden. They did not go out and farm a field. They did not go out and shepherd their own flocks. So if God doesn't provide for them through the sacrificial offerings of the greater Israelite community, what's going to happen to them? You know. Come on. What's going to happen to them? They're going to starve to death. And then who's going to be priests to help you worship the Lord? Nobody. Right? So God builds into this system where the priests have the ability to be sustained through the offerings that are brought by the people, okay? God's very specific on the offering process, very specific how it goes. Not all of the animal is offered, and the priest should get a share. Now, again, God is very specific about how the priests should get their share, okay? That's all built into the system in Leviticus 7. All right, so now let's read verse 13. Here we go. The custom of the priests with the people was that when any man offered sacrifice, the priest's servant would come while the meat was boiling with a three-pronged fork in his hand. Not like this, but like this, you know, like a huge fork, okay? Verse 14. And he would thrust it into the pan. I love this part. Just getting all the cooking utensils covered here. In the pan, or if not the kettle, or the cauldron, or the pot. All that the fork brought up, the priest would take for himself. This is what they did at Shiloh to all the Israelites who came there. All right, we're going to stop right there. Now, I'm just going to give you a quick kind of tidbit of information. This is not what God said to do in Leviticus 7. Okay? This is not the process that was supposed to be happening in the Lord's temple, in the tabernacle at Shiloh. This is, if you read Leviticus 7, you will read nothing about this right here. So before we get to the wanton disregard of the law, they're already off on the wrong foot. Like, they're already not following the Lord, and Hophni and Phinehas are going to make it even worse. So when you read 13 and 14, realize this is not what God called them to do. This is not how the priest... Now, think about it with me, okay? Go home and read Leviticus 7. There's a specific process. It's not this. Now, let me just ask you a question. If you're real keen with that huge three-pronged fork, how much meat do you think you can get out of that pot? Some of us probably get all of it out. Right? And that's not what God wants. Because the people were supposed to get, who brought the sacrifice, were supposed to get some of it, and you were supposed to get a portion of it, not all of it. Because I bet if you put it in the, and if that sucker's not complete, you know how it is. You put a chicken in the pot, and if you pull it out at a certain point, you can get a whole lot more meat than if you wait too long, and then the bone just comes out, right? You think them guys were pretty keen on that fork? Probably so. They did it day after day after day after day after day. They knew exactly when to pull that fork out so they could get the most for themselves. This is not what God called them to do. Now, Hophni and Phinehas are going to take it even worse. Let's read 15, starting 15. Moreover, before, this is Hophni and Phinehas right here. Before the fat was burned, that's not, we'll talk about that in a minute. The priest's servant would come and say to the man who was sacrificing, give me meat for the priest to roast, for he will not accept boiled meat from you, but only raw. Ooh. All right, verse 16. And if the man, this is the person, this is you bringing the sacrifice, said, let them burn the fat first and then take as much as you wish, he would say, no, you must give it now, and if not, I will take it by force. So, they start off saying, well, we got to throw it in this pot and get it boiled, and then we're going to stick this fork in it. And whatever we get out, that's what we get. Whatever's left, well, that's for you. And then they're like, man, I've been eating boiled meat a lot. I'm tired of boiled meat. And so then they come to the guy and say, hey, bud, we're going to take what we want one way or the other. You're either going to give it to me or I'm going to take it from you. Now you say, well, like, okay, they got tired of boiled meat. Like, why can't they have this? Here's the deal. This, again, is not the order of operations that God called them to follow. First, what should have happened is that when the animal was received, they kill it and they do all their stuff to it, and they would give God his portion first. And then the priests would get their cut, and then the people would take the rest of the animal for a meal for themselves. And what are Hophni and Phinehas doing? And what are they directing everybody under their direction, under their leadership to do? Are we not worried about what God gets? It's all about what I want. It's all about me. It's all about mine. I'm going to do whatever it takes to get what I want first, and then everybody else can have whatever they want. If you read Leviticus 7, this whole before the little statement in verse 15, before the fat was burned, listen, it's real. God's real specific. He even says this, that if they eat the fat, go back. Like, you're to be cut off from Israel. You say, well, boy, I like that little gristle part on the steak there. That's the best part. I agree with you. Thankfully, we don't live under the law. But these guys, wanton disregard for the law at every turn. So here's the first thing. You say, well, how did the author in verse 12 say they were worthless and didn't know the Lord? Number one, they did not care about giving God honor and respect in any way, shape, or form. And if that isn't bad enough, listen to what Eli says in a section later in verses 22 through 25. Listen to this. Read it with me. He says, now Eli was very old, and he kept hearing all that his sons were doing to all Israel. Here's the second thing. You ready? How they lay with the women who were serving at the entrance of the tent of meeting. Lay with women is the Old Testament's way of saying they were having sexual relations with women servants in the temple. What were they doing? In essence, they were turning God's house into a pagan prostitution cult. So not only were they disregarding people's sacrificial offerings that people were bringing according to the law to be right with God, not only were they abrogating that into irrelevance, but they were also treating the people who were there working as in any way they wanted to. Can we agree? Worthless, didn't know the Lord, is a pretty good description of these two guys. Absolutely. There's probably some other words we could come up with too. Right? Now here's the crazy part. Or here's the fascinating part. Crazy is not the right word. Here's the fascinating part about how the author constructs this portion of the story. Intermingled in between all of Eli and Hophni and Phinehas' bad is Elkanah, Hannah, and Samuel and all of their good. Because in the previous section, in verses 18 through 21, and then in verse 26, we see that Samuel and his family are models of righteousness, are models of what it means to serve and honor the Lord. And in fact, Samuel and his family serve as a literary technique called they are a foil for the house of Eli. For Eli, Hophni, and Phinehas, they are descending further and further into reprobation and evil. And Samuel and his family are ascending into more righteousness and more righteousness. And remember, before we even started looking at the text, I said one of the purposes of the book of Samuel was that the author is trying to call people back to serve the Lord in real life situations. And we're 3 weeks in to looking at the text of Samuel, and we are already beginning to see what that doesn't look like, House of Eli, and what that does look like, Samuel's family. And we see one is falling further and further and further and further away from the Lord in real life situations. Right? What's the real life situation? They're called to be priests, and they are totally disregarding their job and doing whatever they want to do and whatever they want to do. And Samuel, the text tells us that Samuel, twice it says, and at the end of verse 21 it says, and the boy Samuel grew in the presence of the Lord. And then 5 verses later, in verse 26, it says, now the boy Samuel continued to grow both in stature and in favor with the Lord and also with men. In real life situation, the boy Samuel is growing more toward the Lord than these men are. They are falling further and further away from the Lord. And this young guy, Samuel, is getting better and better and serving the Lord more and more and being more righteous and more righteous in his behavior. And so we see this dichotomy, these polar opposites of people who should know the Lord not doing what they should be doing. And this kid who's just learning about the Lord actually serving the Lord more and more. This story ends, the kind of the last paragraph of this story is the really the beginning of the end for the house of Eli. And so let's look at that really quickly. It starts in verse 27. Verse 27 says, "And there came a man of God." That's like a prophet to Eli and said to him, "Thus says," he's going to tell him two, ask him two questions. "Thus says the Lord, did I indeed reveal myself to the house of your father when they were in Egypt, subject to the house of Pharaoh?" The answer to that question is yes. Yes, that would be Aaron. God revealed himself to Aaron. Yes, verse 28. This is God speaking through the man, through the prophet to Eli. "Did I choose him out of all the tribes of Israel to be my priest, to go up to my altar, to burn incense, to wear an ephod before me?" The answer is yes. God did all that. "And then I gave to the house of your father all my offering by fire from the people of Israel." And here's the kicker in verse 29. "Why then do you scorn my sacrifices and my offerings that I commanded for my dwelling?" Right? So the man of God speaking, being the voice of God to this guy, to Eli, saying, "Hey, why do you scorn me?" And here's kind of the, "And honor your sons above me by fattening yourselves on the choicest parts of every offering of my people Israel." Now, we hadn't gotten that far yet, but a few chapters later, this is why I asked the question earlier, how good do you think they were at sticking that fork in and pulling out more meat than they should? Because the text is going to tell us a little bit later that that Eli is very fat. That's what it says. Right? How you think he got that way? Being keen with that fork and taking the choicest meat from every person day after day after day after day. Now, the kicker of this verse and kind of the point is, "And honor your sons above me." What does that mean? See, now I want to be very clear. God is not judging Eli for what his sons do. Okay? So, this man of God is not saying, "You're guilty because your sons did this." What is the man of God saying to Eli directly? "You're guilty of this." So God is not getting on to Eli for what his sons do. He's holding him accountable for what Eli did. And what is it that Eli did? He honored his sons above the Lord. What does that mean? Well, it can mean a couple things. At best, it means that Eli was complicit in his son's behavior. Sons' behavior. Means he was like turned a blind eye to it. At worst, he was actively involved in it. Now, we didn't read that entire section where Eli confronts his sons about their sexual misconduct in the temple. You'll see, if you go back and read that section, he only gets on to them about that bad behavior. He talks nothing about the disregard of the sacrificial system that God's put in place. And the end of that passage there, where Eli's talking to his sons, the passage ends with this. This is verse 25. This is the author's words, "but they would not listen," so Hophni and Phinehas, "would not listen to the voice of their father, for it was the will of the Lord to put them to death." Now let me ask you a question. Why didn't they listen to their father? This is reading the text. What did he get onto them for? Sleeping with a bunch of women. What did he not get onto them for? disregarded the sacrificial system. Now, why wouldn't he get onto them for that? Because he's involved in it as well. So why didn't they listen to him? Hey, Pops, you over here doing this? Why can't I do that? I mean, you in this too? Well, I got to listen to you. You just as guilty of this. This ain't no different. Sacrifices, women, what's the difference? We ain't got to listen to you. So they didn't listen to him. Right? And so what is the man of God, what is the prophet of God telling Eli? Hey, bud, this is a problem. And God's about to do something about it. This passage ends with this man of God telling Eli that his house is coming to an end. Very bluntly, he says that God's going to cut his house off, legitimately cut it off. He even tells him that Hophni and Phinehas will die on the same day and says that the only member of Eli's family that will be left, there will be only one left, and that person is just left so they can grieve and weep and wail and cry because of the evil that they did and then the punishment that God had to bring on them. Now, that's not how the story ends. The story actually ends on a note of hope. Chapter 2 actually ends on a note of hope. Now, it is not a note of hope for Eli, Hophni, and Phinehas in the house of Eli, but it is a note of hope for the nation of Israel. Because in verse number 35, here's what the prophet says to Eli. He says, this is God's doing, and I will raise up for myself. God will raise up for himself a faithful priest who shall do according to what is in my heart and in my mind, and I will build him a sure house, and he shall go in and out before me, before my anointed forever. Now, who do you think that's going to be? Samuel. Exactly. And so the stage is setting. The house of Eli is declining. The house of Samuel is rising. And we'll see that dichotomy play out next week and the following, right? As Samuel grows in stature with God and with men. So let's talk for a minute. What's the main idea of this story? All right, these last half of chapter 2. I think there's two ideas that are boldly, I mean, that just jump off the page at us. The first one is, listen, as leadership goes, so goes everything else. As leadership goes, so goes everything else. Now, this story takes place on a national scale because Hophni and Phinehas and Eli are priests for the entire nation of Israel. Right? So this is a global scale issue, a national scale issue. And what are they doing to the nation? Are they helping the nation get closer to the Lord? Or are they taking the nation further away from the Lord? Further away. But this story doesn't need to just apply, or the main idea can go further down than just on a national scale. It can go all the way down to a personal level, right? Not to give it away, but the question we're going to ask here in just a minute is, in your circle, are you leading people closer to the Lord or further away? In our families, this same aspect applies, right? As leadership in the family goes, so goes everything else. That doesn't mean that everything's going to work out right and everything's going to happen just peachy perfect every single day. But the reality is, as men, as we lead our families, so goes our family. As pastors, as we lead our churches, so go our churches. Sunday school teachers, as you lead your class, so goes your class. If you're a business leader at work, as you lead, so goes everybody else. And you got two ways. You can either lead them in descent or you can lead them in ascent. That's just reality, right? Now, I want to give you two. Now listen carefully. I'm going to make a distinction. I'm going to give you two points of not application, but implication. Implication. You say, well, what's the difference? All right, main idea, listen to me. This is Hermeneutics 101. By the way, starting August the 4th through the end of September, through the Centennial Association, this is a shameless plug here for a minute, okay? Shameless. On Monday nights from 6 to 7:30, for 8 straight Monday nights, I will be teaching a How to Read Your Bible Better, an Introduction to Biblical Hermeneutics, okay? Through the Centennial Association, it costs $80. It will be college light. There's no credit for it. You can come take it. I promise by the end, well, I can't promise how much you put in. But anyway, if you come, it will help you read your Bible better. Here's one of the things we're going to go over. There's a difference between main idea, implication, and application. Main idea is, what is the text telling us? We don't create that. It's just, what does the text tell us? The text tells us, A, as leadership goes, so everything else goes, right? Application is, how does this apply to my life today? In between those is implication. Implication is, what does the text imply but not explicitly say? Okay, you got what I'm saying? You with me so far? Let me give you an example. Implication. What is one of the implications of this passage? Parenting matters. The text don't tell us parenting matters, but it shows us parenting matters. How does it show us parenting matters? Because there's a vast difference in the way Hannah and Elkanah live and deal with their son Samuel and the way Eli lives and deals with his two sons, Hophni and Phinehas. What's the difference? Different parenting. One parents in righteousness and toward godliness, and one clearly doesn't. So what does the text imply? Parenting matters. Right? Parenting matters. Here's another thing the text implies. Obedience matters. Right? Who is on the ascent in this passage? Samuel. Why? Because he is being obedient to the Lord. Who are the figures that are like the gold star figures in these first two chapters? Hannah, Elkanah. Why? Because they are obedient to the Lord. Who are the F plus or F minus minus in this passage? Eli, Hophni, and Phinehas. Why? Because they are woefully disobedient on so many levels to the Lord. That's implication. Leadership matters. Parenting leadership matters. Obedience matters. All of those things can lead us further toward the Lord or further away from the Lord. Now, what's the other thing this passage is telling us? The second main idea. Here it is. God really cares about His Word, His honor, and how we worship Him. God really cares about those three things. Because let's be real, at the end of the day, in 2025, we could honestly sit back and say, I mean, does it really matter if they boil the meat and stick a fork in it, or they get it raw, or they burn the fat first, or they don't? I mean, like, is it that big a deal? And God's like, yeah, absolutely, it is a big deal. Because this is what I said. Right? Look, we've got similar things today in our culture that people around us might go, oh, that's not a big deal. Is it really a big deal? I mean, come on. Hot button issues. I don't even have to say them. You know them. Hot button issues. Does God really care about that relationship he or she's in? Does God really care if they do it this way versus that way? Like, does God really care? Yeah. Well, why does he care? Because that's what he said. He said, well, why does that matter? Because, look, at the end of the day, somebody's God, and it ain't you and me. And if the God of the Bible is truly the Lord of all creation, then His Word goes, and He really cares about His Word, His honor, and how you and I worship Him. Jesus does, you say, well, what about Jesus? Jesus does the same thing in the New Testament. You can go read Matthew chapter 24, I believe it is, where He lays it on the Pharisees, who are the religious leadership. It's not just Pharisees, but it's the religious leadership of the day, which are the Elis of the day, the house of Eli of Jesus' day. He lays into them. I mean, he calls them whitewashed tombs. look good on the outside, dead on the inside. He tells people, stay away from them. They'll lead you to hell. Read Matthew 24. Jesus does not hold back. Why? Because they're doing the same thing Eli and his people are doing. They are in a position of leadership and they are leading people away from the Lord because they care about what they want to do, not what the Lord says they should be doing. Right? So what are the two main ideas for this passage? As leadership goes, so goes everything else. Number two, God really cares about His Word, His honor, and how we worship Him. Just last night, right? And at first it hit me and it was like, I was like, ooh, I don't know if I'd have said that way. But then I remembered, God really cares about His Word and His honor and how we worship Him. I was on Facebook and I saw a post. And I think what happened, it was like, you know how like some people can share a shared post? And so it's like, there's this little part of it and then there's this and then they share it and add more to it. So it's like, you got to read like a bunch to get down to the thing. Well, anyway, it was this guy, a Facebook friend who had shared this other guy's post, and the other guy's post was about his work as a missionary in Uganda and how he had preached in Uganda and that unfortunately there's large segments of Uganda that are rife with health, wealth, and prosperity gospel. And so he had preached the gospel, which is not that, and had led great revival in Uganda, especially among some of the local Ugandan pastors who were preaching health, wealth, and prosperity. And they had repented and come to the true gospel, right? And so that's the message. And then under that, at the very end, he said, I just saw where Benny Hinn is going to Uganda, and I pray that his revival will be thwarted and God will crush it. And I was like, But God cares about what? His Word, His honor, and how we worship Him. And what we see in this passage is that one day, all those who don't honor His Word, honor Him, and worship Him correctly will be dealt with. And so in that first moment, I was like, ooh. And in the second moment, I was like, you're doggone right. Because that is, the Benny Hinn is not the gospel. That is some heresy, right? And the same thing was going on in Samuel's day with the house of Eli. And the same thing was going on in Jesus' day with the Pharisees. And the same thing is going on with us today. And so as people of God, we've got to care about how we worship Him, we've got to care about His Word, and we've got to care about how we honor the Lord. And so what's the application for us today? And it's two questions of challenge that we should think about this week. Number one, are we leading those under our care, whether it's our family, our at our work, at our church, or at our organization, are we leading those under our care toward God or away from God? You doing one or the other? Which one is it? Second question of application, do we care as much about God's Word, His honor, and how we worship Him as God does? Do we care like He cares? That's the question we all got to answer. All right? So hopefully we can say, yes, I care as much about God. And we can say, yes, I'm leading people in my circle of influence toward God, not away from God. But let's be honest, some days are better than others, right? And so Mr. Ernie's going to come up and we're going to sing a hymn of response. And so I don't know where this lands with you today. You might be in a, hey, yeah, I'm doing okay right now. Great, keep it up. You might be in the place of,